Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. The life of the arts is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization, said JFK. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's show, we will chat with a number of wonderful guests. Paula Key of Bucksport, Wednesdays on Maine, Gabby Montoya-Ironman of the Maine Fiber Frolic, and several vendors and volunteers on site at this year's Maine Fiber Frolic. Welcome, Paula Key, to Creative Maine. You represent the Bucksport Wednesday on Maine Summer Event Series, and you are the chair of this organization. So tell us a little bit about Wednesday on Maine, what the concept is and how it got started.
I certainly would be delighted to. In 2014, the paper mill announced that they were closing. And I had been thinking about doing some sort of summer thing. And as soon as I heard that the mill was closing, I decided to put together a program that would bring entertainment to Main Street, literally to Main Street, live on Main Street, that would sort of plump up our sad town after the paper mill closed. And it was also an economic development effort because we had at that time a few restaurants downtown and merchants, and we all needed a boost after the paper mill closed. So we started in June of 2015, yes. And as I have done every year since, I started with the Frogtown Mountain Puppeteers and invited every kid I could find with the help of the fourth grade folks up at the middle school to come and see the show for free. And it's been a wonderful experience every year. They're fabulous. So that's how we began. And for the first several years until COVID stopped us, we did an event every Wednesday afternoon on Main Street, often under a tent in front of what is now a law office and beauty salon next to the old Rosens building. I've utilized a million different little spots on Main Street and the gazebo on the waterfront. So it's just been a lovely experience for me. And I know it's been good for the town. You know, when you're riding through town and or walking on the sidewalk and you hear wonderful music being played, and a big crowd gathered, it's just happy. So that was the thing. I wanted a little happy because the paper mill closing, even though we all knew it was going to happen one day, it was tough. So that's where we started with.
That's what a wonderful idea. What a wonderful concept. Or are you the originator of the concept of Wednesday on Maine?
I am.
Wonderful. Tell us a little bit about you and what your background is and what road brought you to this position. Now, you did explain the impetus behind it, but what is your journey?
Well, I'm originally from Richmond, Virginia. And in 1980, I took a job as a sales representative for a company that sold legal books, law books. And that brought me to Bucksport, Maine, many other places too. But that's where I met David Key, who is now my dear husband of 42 years. And we met in 80. I moved up here in 80, the end of 81, and we got married in 82. And because I didn't have to work full time anymore, which was a real gift to me, that had never been my life, I was able to get involved in community activities. There was an organization called the Civic Club back in the day, and at one point they were pretty meaningful organization here in town. Back in the 40s, they worked with the paper mill to get the swimming pool built and things like that. They were really great. They did scholarships, etc. So I was able to participate and have time in my life to really learn what it's like to live in a small town, make those connections. It was great. It is great. So that's it. I'm here 42 plus years.
Wonderful. So, getting back to Wednesday on Main, what sorts of arts and artists does the organization focus on? Are you always looking for the unusual, economically viable, little of both?
All of the above. For the most part, I have music events. I have in the past had many speakers. I've had authors. I've partnered with other organizations to promote their events. Happy to do that. And they've been in various venues around town. At the Alamo lately has been the most often. Because it's comfortable for my performers. It doesn't affect the instruments. It's not too humid, you know, that sort of thing. But so that's sort of been what I've been doing. But I really like to do different things. I wrote to the editor of Yankee Magazine. This was pre-COVID. And I wrote to him a few times because he had been around talking to communities about the power of community. And when the mill closed, we really became a community looking for ways to go forward, exploring programs that would help our residents communicate their thoughts on where Bucksport should go in the future. And we implemented a program called Heart and Soul, which was an offshoot of the Orton Family Foundation. The Ortons own the Vermont store catalog. Probably
Vermont
seen,
Country Store.
but it's a lovely program designed specifically for communities in transition. And their focus is to interview and record as many stories from community members as they can. And that was a 2-year process. So I wrote to Mel Allen over at Yankee Magazine. He finally came over and I booked him to speak so he could make me stop writing to him, so he said. And he was amazing and fell in love with Bucksport. And he ended up writing an 18-page article on Bucksport, the town that would not die. So that's in the Yankee Magazine archives. And it was about the mill closing, how that affected people, what we were planning to do in the future. And it was all very lovely and heartfelt and moving and sort of, to me, inspirational for other communities going through the loss of their major business, whatever it might be, a factory, a plant, whatever. And it was quite a thing. And then COVID hit and we were all stopped in our tracks.
Yes, well, if the arts has power to do anything, it's to heal a gap like that, I would think. Is that part of your experience? Do you think that?
Interesting. It absolutely did because Patricia Ranzoni has a book called Still Mill, which is a compilation of writings from community members, I think over 300, talking about how the mill closing affected them, how their lives were here in town, generations of mill workers, and what that meant to them. It's a whole different social structure for men who are working in the mill. Suddenly their community is gone completely. That's been a phenomenon really nationwide. So Wednesday on May, I partnered with the Maine Humanities organization and a few other organizations, and we brought Pat Ranzoni to Bucksport's Alamo Theater and many of her her folks who had submitted writings, and they were all read, and we had an exhibit of artifacts that had been salvaged from the mill before it closed. It was an amazing thing, and it was really, really moving. It just was sort of cathartic and a very healing moment, I thought. It was great. And Mel Allen from Yankee Magazine was our facilitator.
Oh, perfect.
It just
Perfect.
really all dovetailed together. And it was quite an event. And the curator of the artifacts, which I believe was Julia Gray, she did an amazing job. You can't imagine. I've never been into the mill. I never saw that. So I had no idea what to expect. But it was just wonderful. You know, signs and helmets or hard hats and just all sorts of stuff. So yes, the arts can heal. Absolutely.
Now, I noticed now last summer there was a big sign as you came across the bridge from Verona Island toward Bucksport. There was a big sign that said New England town or something like that, typical New England town, turn left. And I know that Bucksport was hoping for more tourist dollars. Do you think Wednesday on Main has expanded tourism to Bucksport in a quantifiable way?
Well, it's very hard to quantify that.
Yes.
I know it has. I couldn't tell you the numbers, but I know it has because I've met people from all over the place who have come to our events, who've stopped in on Main Street, who have, yes. So I would say yes. And that sign was, of course, that caused a lot of interest. You know, it was a wonderful sign, and hopefully it had some effect. I don't know.
Well, I hope so.
I
Do
hope so.
you think other businesses or businesses, I should say, in Bucksport are becoming more arts friendly? Are they recognizing that the arts are a very important thing in a town's health?
Well, we don't have a lot of businesses left, Adina. We have little retail. I know Book Sacks, Andy, that owner of Book Sacks, is all about the arts and culture. He knows what it can do for community, and he's been wonderful, a wonderful support to Wednesday on Main and everybody else that's doing making any effort at community involvement or economic development. He's the center of our universe, sort of. So I would say that if there's a merchant here, they know that economic development and cultural arts development go hand in hand. I know they
Okay.
do. It's just a matter of how many merchants we can support here, which is, it's difficult. It's very hard. So I know that everyone who's on Main Street or in the business around, even the like the little restaurants out on 46, everybody's supportive. It's just they've been wonderful over the years.
That's great. So how can WERU listeners experience Wednesday on Main and participate in the organization? And what advice would you give to other communities with similar positions, similar goals?
Well, I would say the most important thing for WERU listeners and anyone else in the community is to come to our performances. Please know that Wednesday on Main is going to be happening every year. We have an online presence. We've got a lovely website and
Which is what's the address of that website?
a website is Bucksport, WOM. Oh, no, that's my email. Sorry. It's Wednesday. You can just Google Wednesdays on Main. And it'll come up. So
Okay.
on Bucksport, WOM.com, is that right?
Is it .com or .org?
No, it's not .org. we're not an entity. We are under the umbrella of the town of Bucksport. They are our fiscal agent, and they are a nonprofit. So when we have sponsors and donations, all of those donations are tax deductible, as any nonprofit donation would be. So that's been a help to me. It's a huge help. The town has been right there with me since day one, 2015, the day one. So
So
when
let's
I
say another town with a similar problem who has, for instance, lost its main source of employment and so forth, wants to do something similar to stimulate tourism and business in their town. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I think they first have to have an underwriter, a financial underwriter, and to some degree, because every performer that I, everyone that comes to Wednesday on Main is paid. All of our performers, all of our speakers. So you have to have some money, and there's promotional money that's required for advertising, printing, that sort of stuff. But I think what was is the most necessary is a dedicated person to manage the process. I book all of the performers. I write all of the copy for the press releases. I liaison with WERU or whoever I'm partnering with. I talk to the press. I talk to media. So I'm really sort of the jack of all trades when it comes to promoting it. And so, in another community, if you have people that can handle those duties, then that's what needs to happen. I would just say to don't be afraid if you have an event that is not well attended. Don't give up. If you can, if you have enough money to sustain an effort like that. And connect with your community. Talk to people, get local sponsors, get volunteers involved to put up posters, what you're doing and why you're doing it. It can be benefits for a cause. There's all sorts of ways to start doing some of this kind of work.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I've very much enjoyed our conversation. I think what you're doing is tremendous. Anything that is pro arts, I'm all about. And so is WERU, who is a media sponsor of Wednesday on Main. Well, have a wonderful rest of your summer, of your Wednesdays on Main season, and I look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you so much, Paula Key.
Thank you, Adina. Be well.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Today's calendar segment highlights two major September festivals. Saturday, September 14th, is a busy day for Maine. The Machias Fiber Festival will take place on September 14th at the Elm Street School, 38 Jacksonville Road in East Machias, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. The festival features vendors, contests, and more for fiber craft lovers. For more information, call 207-271-0937 or email machiasfiberfestival@gmail.com. Also taking place on September 14th is the 48th annual Orland River Day, a festival celebrating the town of Orland and the beautiful river that runs through it. From 9:30 to 2:30, come down to Narramissic Drive on the river and enjoy a parade, fiddlers, contra dancing, a street full of vendors, a macro canoe and kayak race, a leisurely paddle from upper to lower dam, Orland Historical Society tours, kids' games, food, and more. If you would like to be a vendor, be in the parade, or need further information, email orlandriverday@gmail.com or call the Orland Town Office at 207-469-3186. Follow Orland River Day's Facebook page for more news. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. Coming up now on Creative Maine is a lively visit to the Maine Fiber Frolic, Maine's largest fiber festival. First, we speak with the organizer of the event, Gabby Montoya Ironman. And then I take you around the Windsor Fairgrounds to speak with some fascinating, passionate, and creative Mainers. Welcome, Gabby Montoya Ironman, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad you're here on the program. Today we are going to talk about Maine's largest fiber festival. And Gabby is going to tell us what that means, what a fiber festival is, and why it's important, and all that she does for Maine's fiber community, which is tremendous. So Gabby, welcome. And can you tell us, what is a fiber festival and what does that mean?
Well, thank you for having me. And to me, the Fiber Festival is a community gathering of people who love fiber in all its different iterations. So the Maine Fiber Frolic is actually a nonprofit, membership nonprofit, and our official mission is about promoting and advancing the Maine fiber industry and the fiber industry in general through the event of the Maine Fiber Frolic.
So by fiber, we don't mean dietary fiber here. We're talking crafting, yarn.
Fibers, and not necessarily just animal, because we do have people who do flax processing, gorse, you know, or throw a little silk in their yarn, or other plant fibers can be used as still as fiber. And even in some of the years when we have the Maine Fiber Frolic, I invite, we have some wood carvers who come and do a demonstration. Wood is technically also a fiber.
Yeah.
So we have everything fiber and fiber adjacent. We often invite or have people ask to come and bring, you know, goat milk soap, because goats also produce fiber and we need soap too, and to clean our wool goods and fiber goods. But our mission is to promote the businesses that, and to have this event. And it kind of kicks off the year for, like, because it's one of the earliest festivals and fairs in the state of Maine, being so early in June. And we're always like crossing our fingers for the weather, because you never know what it's going to be. But
So the Fiber Frolic is put on at the first week of June, usually.
The first full weekend of June every year is when we've had it, except for during COVID, and the year after COVID, we had took a break for that. But it's the first full weekend. So this year it was actually the first and second, and next year it'll be the 7th and 8th, because the first lands on Sunday.
Okay, so what is the origin story of the Fiber Frolic?
The Fiber Frolic started in 2020, and I wasn't part of the frolic at that time. I was not living in Maine, but from what the previous president and members have told me, that it was a group of alpaca and sheep farmers in the area who said, Maine needs to have our own sheep and wool festival. And at that time, there was a lot, I think alpaca was kind of having their little bit of a boom cycle, where there was a lot of alpaca in Maine. I think that's kind of level plateaued out, but they decided they needed to have a festival where they could have a bigger event instead of just, you know, a few vendors here and there. They wanted to get the whole fairgrounds and have a lot of vendors. So we typically have 80 to 90 vendors every year. And we do have some that are outside of Maine, but it's like maybe 10% of them is. I think we even have had some that were a little further. We had one woman who came all the way from Pennsylvania yarn, dyed yarns, and also farms who actually take their product all the way from, they have a flock of sheep or a flock of, I don't know if it's a flock of alpaca, I would have heard of alpaca,
Heard.
heard of alpaca, and they get that product processed into a value-added product of yarn or something else, whether it's like socks or sweaters or something, and they come and vend at the Fiber Frolic.
So you are the president of the Maine Fiber Frolic. Is it
Yes.
association or
It's just the Maine Fiber
the Maine
Frolic.
Fiber Frolic? And you're also the finance director of the Sunrise County Economic Council. And so you have a background in finance and economics. So what is the importance of a festival like the Fiber Frolic in terms of economics, education, agriculture, community, all those very important things?
To me, it's very important as part of the fiber community that I've made so many great friendships in this area in Maine that I'm a volunteer. Like everyone in the Fiber Frolic is a volunteer. We're not paid, but I get a lot out of it personally. And I think the rest of the team feels the same way, that it's a really great community here. And this is our time at the beginning of the good weather to get together. Tent sale, which basically is all the local, and these are all only from Maine, the sheep and alpaca and rabbit fibers, and some goat gets brought there, and we help those growers sell that product at a much higher price than they would be able to sell to some, bulk. So that gives them a little bit more margin for their business to keep going and feeding those animals and keeping their locally grown fiber and yarn in the system, in the economy, and same thing for the and then we also have our used equipment sale, which is huge, kind of like a yard sale, but we take 10% of the sale and the rest goes back to the person who brings their spinning wheel they want to sell, or and we have volunteers that run that sale so people can sell a spinning wheel or a or some kind of equipment or some knitting books or something like that, makes a little bit of money for the Fiber Frolic. But
Yeah.
I haven't, I don't know. I keep meaning to ask the vendors, like keep meaning to ask the vendor coordinator. I'm like, reach out to the vendors and ask them what their, can we get like a survey of what is their total sales for the weekend? But because I know they keep coming back, so they must be doing really well. And those people are walking out of there with bags of yarn. There's like a lot of yarn going out. And that's
Absolutely. I
their
see people with garbage bags full of fleece
Yeah, all
and
the
spinning wheels
fleeces.
under their arms and
Yeah, so I know it's just for the piece that we have, which is the fleece show, the used equipment sale, and the ticket sales, because you pay $5 to get in, which we try to keep it very accessible for the community, and it's free for kids. We usually have about $50,000 of cash for the weekend that receipts that goes through. For the weekend, and that doesn't count vendor sales. That's just the Fiber Frolic piece of, and I know the food vendors do really well as well. We usually try to limit it to about 10, and I told them that maybe next year we'd have a couple more because we had two different food vendors that ran out of food on the first day, and they were like, we have to go shopping right now as soon as they close, and they left to go get more food
Wow.
because they were like, we
So
thought we had enough, we didn't.
would you
It was
say that the
crazy.
vendors are the backbone of your festival? Or do you think the classes and community is more of the backbone?
I don't know. I think that the classes are kind of like a bonus. That's not really what our main thing is. Our main thing is to have give the vendors a place to come and sell their products, and the sheep grow the fiber growers to sell their fleece. Used equipment sales also nice too. But the vendors are definitely, that's why we're there. We're there to give them a venue.
When you choose your vendors, do you go in wanting a particular mix, or is it first come, first serve?
Pretty much first come, first serve. We have a lot of regular ones that come back every year and request, I want to be in this spot, the same spot I was in, the last however many years. And then we have a little few new ones every year too, but we have a very regular core that comes. And then like if we have a new vendor come in, we'll be like, well, we already have, two goat soap vendors, or we can't really have another one. So we
Right.
try not to like do too much of that, where it's like we don't want to have 20 people selling soap. We only need a
Yeah.
couple, you know.
Well, I have met this year, and we'll talk to them shortly. Several very interesting vendors, including botanical dye vendor, a soap vendor, some knitwear designers. This event attracts everyone in the industry. So some of the activities for fairgoers, including classes that they can take, include some volunteer activities. Who are your volunteers, and what are some of the volunteer positions?
Well, we have a really awesome team of core volunteers that are the ones that through the year are getting everything together, whether it be the vendor coordinator. She's a year-long volunteer and she's processing those vendors that are signing up to vend. That's a volunteer position. And then we have about 12 other people who are the core team that work on the frolic basically from December until it starts. And there's the ticket booth coordinator, the marketing coordinator, entertainment coordinator, because we hire live music. We hired a clown this year for the kids and he was doing balloon animals and
Oh,
stuff.
fun.
We have a children's area coordinator, the fleece tent coordinator, the music equipment coordinator, and those are like big jobs. But then we
Okay.
have the regular core volunteer job, which is about 150 positions that we fill in the frolic, like ticket booth, people who sit in the ticket booth and sell tickets, those are volunteers. People who work in the children's area are volunteers. People who are running, because it's not just one person working in the fleece tent all weekend. It's a team of four or five people at a time, but you only work like a 3 or 4 hour shift. And then you get to go enjoy the frolic for the rest of the time you're there. We always try to make it so that we love having our volunteers, but we want them to also be able to come and enjoy the frolic. So
Sure.
they're like, yeah, do
So
your shift and then go have fun.
then go have fun. So how can our WERU listeners get involved in next year's frolic, both as attendees or as volunteers?
Well, you can come go to the we have a Facebook page, Maine Fiber Frolic, and we also have a website where you can find contact information for all the whole team to reach out and find out how to volunteer. We have a volunteer sign up form in the website, fiberfrolic.com. You can come and volunteer just for the weekend, which we love all those volunteers as well because we can't do without them. It's an entirely volunteer run event, but
Okay, so for more information, you go to fiberfrolic.com.
fiberfrolic.com, or you can even go to the Facebook page, Maine Fiber Frolic.
Sure. So for the rest of the year, what can people do to feed their love of the fiber arts and crafts during the rest of the year?
There's lots of things around the state of Maine. I know sometimes Open Farm Day is one of the ones that I think it already happened this year, but it does provide, sometimes there are farms that are open that are fiber farms early July or late June, and a lot of farms will be open. And then there's the Machias Fiber Festival, which happens this year. It's on September 14th, and it's in Machias at the Elm Street Elementary School. And we have about 30 vendors there at
Okay.
that festival. And then there's the Common Ground Fair, has a very vibrant fiber community area there where we have the Maine Fiber vendors and we also have the fleece tent and we have the Wednesday spinners who are having their own tent where they're doing, and then there's a lot of fiber arts vendors too. And I do want to put a tiny plug in for the Northeast Hand Spinners Association, which is a multi-state organization which Maine is also involved in, and the focus is on making yarn. So it's more niche even than the Maine Fiber Frolic, whereas Maine Fiber Frolic is like anything you want to do with fiber, it's there. Everything from sewing and knitting and crocheting and spinning and everything.
Okay, well, this is great. I appreciate all your expertise and your information. Thank you so very much for joining us on Creative Maine, and
Thank
I look
you.
forward to seeing you in September at Machias.
I will be there.
Thank you so much. Hello, welcome to Creative Maine Goes to Town.
I am here at the Maine Fiber Frolic at the Windsor Fairgrounds. It is June 1st, 2024. I am starting in the fleece barn and breathing in the heady fiber fumes. We are here with all the creatives of Maine who love fiber, knitting, crochet, felting, weaving, all the fiber crafts. There are animals here. There are vendors who are selling not only yarn and fiber, but also equipment, dyes, and we'll meet some of them soon. But since I'm starting in the fleece barn, I want to introduce you to Stacy, who is judging fleece, and I'm going to let her introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Stacy Wilson from Stacy's Spinning Haven, located up in Milford, Maine. And today I'm at the Maine Fiber Frolic, and I'm the wool judge.
And what does that actually mean? What qualities are you judging in wool? Is it as it comes off the animal?
Yeah, today what I'm looking for is overall characteristics of a fleece after it has been shorn from the sheep. The farms choose what fleeces they want to enter. And then I have to look for consistency in crimp, consistency in length. Did they skirt the fleece, meaning did they get the vegetable matter out? Is it clean? Presentation, when I lay the fleece out, do I see what looks like a sheep laying on my table? These are all things that, as a wool judge, I'm looking for to help the farms grow in what they can do to change, but it also increases the value of the fleece.
So we have a lot of hand spinners here at the Fiber Frolic. So a good, clean fleece is definitely making the spinner's job easier, right?
It is. It makes the processing easier for your spinners. Your hand spinners don't want a lot of vegetable matter in their fleeces. They don't want a lot of manure tags attached to their fleeces. It's not a lot of fun to clean. They're also looking for, maybe they're not processing themselves, but they're sending to a mill. And a mill doesn't want all of that vegetable matter either. So we're trying to give them the best product back. That's what they're looking for today, something that they can process themselves, or they can send to someone like me who can do the processing for them.
You have a mill.
I do. I own Stacy's Spinning Haven Fiber Mill up in Milford. I've been running the mill for the past 2 years. I got it in 2022. But I've been processing for the last 14. I started in a 5-gallon bucket, and I used hand cards, and I was a hand spinner. And I've worked my way up from there. I don't own the fiber animals, as my passion is truly in processing and fleeces themselves, not the animals as much.
So this is, you make what we would refer to as farm yarn.
I do. I make farm yarn. Farm yarn I would consider more like hand-spun yarn. This is mill yarn versus commercial yarn. There are three different types of yarn that I would classify. There's your hand-spinner's yarn, which can be inconsistent. There's your mini mill yarn, which is small batches, and you get the fiber right back from your animal. And then there's your commercial grade yarn, more what you buy at Hobby Lobby, Walmart, those kind of places. Those would be the commercial. They're usually warehouse size mills. I'm a very small one-person run mill.
Can our listeners come visit your mill? Is there a tour available?
I am more than happy for people to come and schedule an appointment to come by and tour the mill. It is out of my home and my basement. And I don't have the farm animals. So it is just the mill. You have to schedule by appointment. You can do that through stacyspinninghaven.com. That's my website. And you can also reach me there for my email.
If you go to a yarn store in Maine, is there a way that a customer will know that the wool that they're fondling came from your mill?
There is. Most of my yarn is not in stores. It's at farm stands, at farmers markets. There is a local store called Heavenly Yarn. They're in Belfast. She has a Maine-only fiber section. There may be yarns there that I've processed.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, and have a wonderful weekend. It's a beautiful sunny day.
I'm still at the Maine Fiber Frolic, enjoying this beautiful day, and I'm here with Jody Clayton, who is the proprietor of, what do we call our shop? One Loop in Fiber Arts.
Yes, and Maine Yarn and Fiber Supply, two wings, one business.
Where are you located, Jody?
We're located at 170 Park Street in Bangor, Maine.
Awesome. And so I know that you're a hand dyer, but you also have another part of your business where you represent other Maine crafters. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the One Lupin boutique side of the business is gifts, apparel, etc. Maine Yarn and Fiber Supply is fiber. And on the One Lupin side, I work primarily with domestic producers for jewelry, clothing, cards, so forth. And we have quite a few Maine-based creative makers that are independent micro business owners themselves that wholesale, and I purchase work from them that I then sell in the store.
Such as what sort of products?
Pottery. We carry pottery from the Potter's House. She's located right in Litchfield. We have cards from Color Afoot, which is Peggy Lumpkin, and she lives in Brownville, and she's a fabulous artist. We've carried chocolates in the past from Maine. We have Angel Rocks clothing. Angel Rocks is located in Biddeford, so that's an example. We also have jewelry from Maine, several different jewelers. So, and there's much more, but that kind of gives you an idea.
Wonderful. So tell me about the dyeing and what your niche is in the indie dye world.
Okay. Our niche at the moment is small scale, consistent, great color. We're doing small batch dye work primarily for our retail store and our website. I also wholesale, and I'll be expanding my wholesale for my yarns. I've been doing that for a few years. I started as a wholesaler with the felt work, so kind of wading into that a little bit. But what we really want is high quality yarn and fiber, much of which is domestically produced, some of which is produced here in Maine. And then we hand dye it downstairs in small batches. We'll do custom color runs for yarn shops. We do custom colors for our customers as well. And so it's really about quality and consistency and, you know, making people happy.
So I guess you enjoy being at a festival like this. You can reach people from all over, not just the people in Bangor. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's nice to see people year after year. I've been doing the Fiber Frolic since, I think, 2003 or 4. So long time. And it's just fun to see folks come up from parts far away. And it's also, even though I have a retail store, it's always nice to get out in a slightly different context and get feedback, you know, and see what people like, what works, what they're thinking about, what's trending. And at a fair like this, because the Fiber Frolic is just a beautiful, under-advertised kind of little secret show. I'd like everybody to know about it. It's a beautiful location, and on a day like this, everybody's so happy, which is very nourishing, right, to be around a lot of people brought together in pursuit of things that they all enjoy commonly and have people just be so happy. It's a long winter in Maine, so we really earn days like this.
Absolutely. I know. I am really happy to be here. So I see you're working with a lovely designer.
Yes. Yes. Bristol Ivy is a resident Bangor, and she grew up in this area. And when she and her husband moved back up here just before COVID, we kind of connected, and she was looking for some part-time work, and I was not ever going to turn Bristol Ivy down. So she works a couple days in the store, and she helps me here and there, and I'm happy to trade off so you can talk to her a little bit too, because she's a wealth of knowledge. She's a great example of the depth of resource that we have here in Maine. We're super lucky. We've got a great history of production of wool, sheep on the land to yarn, and we have quite a considerable depth of designers that live here in Maine, many of whom are a bit younger, and really bringing us incredible knitwear designs and energy and an eye that helps keep knitting relevant internationally. So we really, it's unbelievable that so many of them reside in Maine, and Bristol's one of them.
Bristol is an internationally known designer. Does she design with your yarn?
Sometimes she does. Yes, she has done. We got her shawl over there, and this is Anther, her T-shirt, and I've knitted up in my yarn. She's worked up a couple other designs, and she teaches at this shop as well.
Wow.
Every time her classes don't fill to the brim, I'm like, come on, people, do you not understand who this is?
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me. I'm speaking with Bristol Ivy, who works with Jody Clayton. And she is, for the uninitiated, an internationally known knitwear designer who has published a number of books. And I was asking, Bristol, why are you here in Maine as opposed to anywhere else in the known universe?
There's a couple of different reasons. One is just Maine is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. I moved here when I was 3 with my family, and I can't imagine going anywhere else. When my husband got his job, when he graduated from grad school, he was looking around all over the place, and I was just like, please, Maine, please, can we stay in Maine? But it also, all of the natural beauty here is just unbelievable, so inspiring. But in addition, the community within the fiber industry in Maine is astonishing in its volume. The number of farms, the number of yarn producers, the number of dyers, the number of people that just work in fiber-adjacent industries is astronomical. So there is always a sense of community. There is always a sense of mentorship in being able to both give and receive from all of the amazing people in the area. So yeah, it's been amazing kind of coming up in this location because I've gotten so much education just from the people around me.
That's fantastic. So I know you've published a number of books. What is your latest one?
So my latest one came out in 2019, right before the pandemic. So that was great timing. And it's called Knitting Outside the Box, Drape and Fold. And that's a sequel to my first book, which was called Knitting Outside the Box. And the first one is about how to think outside the box with knitting, but how to use some exercises to maybe promote creativity a little bit, and then looking at the different ways that you can manipulate your fabric as you're making it. The second book is taking that same thing further with looking at how to manipulate your fabric after you make it. So looking at twisting your fabric, pleating your fabric, stuff like that, because it's kind of the difference between pattern making and draping, if you look at the fashion context. So yeah, it's a really cool exploration. Well, I think it's cool.
So do a lot of other people.
It's a really cool exploration of where we can push knitting, because knitting is fabric, right? We can do with it what we want to achieve what we want. You're good.
Oh, it's good. It's all about touching and feeling. Absolutely.
The perfect background. You're good.
So just tell our listeners where they can find your classes and your books and so forth.
Absolutely. So you can find them on my website at bristolivy.com, BristolIvy.com. I'm on Ravelry as Bristol Ivy. I'm on Instagram as Bristol Ivy, trying to keep everything on the same note. And you can also sign up for my newsletter on my website. That's kind of the best way to find out about where I'm going to be.
Perfect. Thank you so much and enjoy this wonderful weekend.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
And I'm here at foragecolor.com with Jackie Otino, and I want to talk to Jackie about what she does, which is very interesting. Jackie, you dye with natural dyes, is that right?
I do dye with natural dyes. I grow a lot of dyes, and I forage around for some other dyes, and then I also import dyes from around the world that are natural dyes. And I dye yarns and fiber with them, and I teach workshops from time to time.
And Jack, you also sell the dye stuffs, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So what foraged dyes come from Maine, actually?
Let's see. Sumac is a good one. Staghorn sumac, black walnut, goldenrod, of course, in the fall, lupin leaves.
What colors do you get from lupin leaves?
You can get a lot of green material like that will give you some shade of yellow, but from time to time you can get some pinks from those. And I grow coreopsis and matter root and weld flowers. Did I say marigolds, coreopsis, things like that I grow in my garden, indigo I grow. Well, I've always been a very fibery person. I learned to knit in high school, and then in college I found someone to teach me how to spin, and I bought my first spinning wheel from the Uncle Henry's. And just kind of like clacked around on it for years until I got serious and really kind of focused on spinning. And then, I don't know, after college I went to midwifery school. I know. And then I had some kids and I ended up working for a local brand that was a small fledgling yarn company, and they were a natural dye house. And so I didn't know how to dye, but I was like, I can do that. And so I applied and they hired me, and I basically taught myself how to dye. I learned how to dye colors. When I started at that yarn company, we had like 8 colors. And then when I left, we had like 150 recipes or something.
Wow, that's incredible. Is there a standardization, or do you get what you get?
You know, there's a lot of math. Dyeing is a lot of math, right? But natural dyes, you know, depending on the soil, on the weather, on the growing conditions, like you can get different years are going to give you different colors. So like, especially when I was working in commercial dyeing, we would get a new batch of whatever dye and we would always run a test sample. And sometimes it was a totally different color from the last round and we would have to reformulate the recipe a little bit. Because when you're commercially dyeing, lot 101 has to look like lot 102. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So where in Maine are you located?
I'm on the Midcoast in Searsmont.
Very cool. So how can people find you, find your workshops, find your products?
My website is foragecolor.com, and on Instagram I'm forage_color, and that's probably the best place to look. I'm most active on that site.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. Have a wonderful show. We have a beautiful weekend.
Oh, it's amazing out. Thanks so much for stopping.
Thank you. I'm here at the Maine Fiber Frolic with Matt and Sarah. And Matt and Sarah Perkins, yes? From Pittston, Maine. And they sell the most delightful smelling soap you've ever smelled. I'm standing here over the display just breathing it in. So we're going to talk to them a little about their business and how they got started and what they do. So Sarah, tell me a little bit about yourself and I guess the origin story of your business.
So I'm Sarah, and we make all of our own goat milk soap. We raise our goats. We got started, I grew up on a large generational family farm. Matt grew up on a farm with his family as well. And so we knew that we would have livestock. And when Matt brought home some goats, we decided that we would start figuring out what to do with the milk, and we did soap.
Do you have a particular breed of goat that you raise?
No. So we raise registered Alpine dairy goats, yeah.
Do you also sell other kinds of things like cheese or so forth?
So we don't do any food products right now. All of the milk that we raise goes into the soap, and each year we need more and more. The soap is in high demand, so we need more and more milk each year. So we do increase our herd each year, but still all of the milk is designated for the soap.
Well, I see on your sign you have a long list of the benefits of goat's milk soap. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. Goat milk is packed with vitamins and minerals. So it's much more dense and richer in vitamins and minerals than cow's milk. Although cow's milk is wonderful, but goat's milk is very nourishing to your skin, very healing on your skin. So which is what the big draw is for goat milk soap. And so it takes care of blemishes and acne and rosacea and fine lines. And a lot of people use it if they just have some unknown, you know, condition that they've got going on their skin. A lot of times the goat milk and the vitamins and minerals in it will be very effective with it. Yeah.
Great. So where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and otherwise in person?
Yeah. So we have a website at ledgewayfarm.com, and we ship all over the country.
Thank you very much for speaking with us on WERU.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Hi, my name is Lacey Glidden. I have the privilege to run Maritime Family Fiber. So basically how it started was when I was little, I grew up on a sheep farm in Down East, Maine. My mom and dad still have a sheep farm that we run, and we would go across the border to Harvey Station, New Brunswick, to Briggs & Little Woolen Mill, who's been in operation for over 160 years, longer than Canada's been a country, and we would trade our raw fleeces for yarn. And they approached me about 7 years ago and asked if I would like to become the U.S. distributor to make the yarn more available in the U.S. So that's what we've been doing. Close to the animals, close to the people, close to the earth. So it really is a privilege.
And your mother also works with you, adjacent to you?
Yes, she does. So her business is called Homespun Girls, and she taught me everything I know. And she's an indie dyer, so she hand paints the yarn. And she's also obviously very involved with the wool and the sheep and running the farm, the day-to-day, everything that entails.
So if our listeners want to find you and find your wonderful yarn and see your beautiful pictures of gorgeous Down East Maine, where can they go?
Yes, yeah, so we have a website, maritimefamilyfiber.com, but we are also on social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. We like to hold a lot of giveaways and book clubs and those sort of things on those pages, so definitely check those out if you're on social media.
Thank you so much, Lacey. Have a wonderful show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to my wonderful guests, Paula Key, Gabby Montoya-Ironman, Jody Clayton, Bristol Ivy, Stacy Wilson, Lacey Glidden, Jackie Otino, and Matt and Sarah Perkins. We had so much fun learning about Wednesday on Maine and the Maine Fiber Frolic and all the many exciting endeavors taking place under that banner. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on September 19th at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, when we will immerse ourselves in the legend, lore, and sounds of Maine's R.B. Hall Day Community Band Festival. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson, wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.